Thank you so much, Roger Mark. And it's such an honor to be with my colleagues from Bangladesh and Germany, and because I'm just so appreciative of all the work that you're doing. And working as a human rights attorney, human rights and climate change are completely interlinked. And this COP, what I've been told, is really focusing on that issue. And I'm taking a sheikh's term about climate warriors. And you've heard about the climate warriors in Bangladesh and India. And there are climate warriors in Alaska. And these are the people who are being affected now by climate change, and with very limited resources, taking extraordinary steps to adapt and protect their livelihoods and the way that they're living. So I'm really passionate about this issue because climate change is happening in Alaska faster than anywhere else on the planet, in the Arctic. And just to give you an example, so Alaska, people would think snow by December. We had no snow in Alaska when I left last Wednesday. No snow in Anchorage, Alaska. Even in mountains as high as 5,000 feet, I flew into the interior of Alaska in the beginning of November, and there was no snow. So the fact that climate change is happening and accelerating is really a critical issue for all of us to be thinking about. Also, I'm sure you're aware of all the snow that got dumped on Buffalo. Well, the reason that happened, if you don't know, is because there was a super typhoon in the Pacific where there were sustained winds of 185 miles per hour for more than 24 hours, and that went up the Bering Sea on the west coast of Alaska and brought all this warm air, so we've been above freezing in addition to having no snow, and then the jet stream is wobbling now, right? Because, and they think it's because of decreased Arctic sea ice. So we have already, you know, I get concerned because at the COP negotiations, it's all about keeping our temperature increases to below 2 degrees Celsius. But in Alaska, we're already at 3.5 degrees Celsius increase since 1975. And there's been a lot of research, of course, being done now. So in Barrow, Alaska, which is in the northernmost part of our state, in the month of October, there has been a 13 degree Fahrenheit increase since the 1970s. So that's from the 1970s to 2009. And of course, these temperature increases are having profound impacts on the environment. So decreased Arctic sea ice, thawing permafrost, which is leading to these accelerated rates of erosion, and repeated extreme weather events. So we don't get hurricanes in Alaska, but we do get hurricane strength winds like the super typhoon that came up through the Bering Sea just a couple of weeks ago. I always talk about Arctic sea ice because for climate deniers, there's no denying what's happening with Arctic sea ice. And there was the first time that a documented record low occurred was in 2007. And that's when I decided to go back to graduate school and get my PhD and went to my first climate conference. And at that climate conference, climate scientists were saying that there would be no Arctic sea ice at the earliest during the summertime by 2100, and maybe as an outlier 2050. Then we get this documented low in 2012, which was 3 weeks earlier than the normally documented record low. And I was with an Inupiaq whaler in January who said there could be no Arctic sea ice in the summertime within the next 10 years, right? And so just in the span of 7 years, that the changes that are happening and why this urgency about adaptation and resilience is so critical, and really what that means in regard to how we're going to make sure that people's human rights are protected. So the focus of my talk is on population displacement, which is, based on my research, one of the most profound consequences that will be caused by climate change. It will happen all over the world, and we, unfortunately, are completely unprepared based on what's been happening in Alaska for the fact that millions of people are not going to be able to not only live where they currently live, but their livelihoods are obviously going to be affected, whether they're subsistence whalers or working at a local store down the street that no longer exists. So there has been a huge amount of research that's been done, or government studies on the climate relocations that are happening in Alaska. And the U.S. Government Accountability Office is one of the federal government agencies that's been doing research or studying this issue. And in 2003, they did work in Alaska, and they found that there were three communities that were seeking to relocate, and 184 other indigenous communities were being affected by flooding and erosion. And there are 229 indigenous federal tribes in Alaska, so 184 of them, that was about 86% of the indigenous villages in Alaska, were being affected by erosion and flooding. Those three communities, Kivalina, Shishmaref, and Newtok, some of you have maybe heard about them. They've been in the news a lot. They are climate warriors. They have been trying to educate everyone. They've met with Congress, they've met with the White House, and talked about the urgency of their situation because they have chosen to relocate. They have made the decision. They can't stay where they are. They need to move to a different place. But protecting their livelihoods has been essential and has made this discussion of relocation truly, truly difficult. So 6 years later, the federal government went back and went, wow, these three communities, they haven't been relocated. What's going on? And the problem is there are no government in the United States, no federal, state government agencies that have any mandate to relocate populations. There's no funding available specifically for relocation. So those are significant, but the really big piece was just in the span of 6 years, a number of communities that were thinking about relocating quadrupled. And unfortunately, still no community has yet relocated. So these are the 12, this is a map of the state of Alaska, and these are photographs of some of those 12 communities that have been thinking about relocation. All of these communities, as I mentioned, are indigenous tribes. None of them are connected by roads. Subsistence is, I can't overemphasize how important subsistence is to their culture and community, which means that they rely on the resources in their vicinity. And so for Kivalina, which you can see is on the northern coast, and Shishmaref just a little bit south, they are on barrier islands. And with Kivalina and Shishmaref, they have chosen relocation sites to maintain their livelihoods, which is subsistence. And the federal government has come back because there have been no guidelines of how you choose a relocation site, to whom do you go to figure out if your relocation site is appropriate. And the federal government has come back multiple times and said these relocation sites will not work because this permafrost is going to thaw. And so both of these communities are in a stalemate, meaning they're not going anywhere. They're in an extraordinarily dangerous situation. So when that super typhoon was going up the Bering Sea coast, all I could think about was praying that nobody would die, because there is no evacuation route. These are barrier islands, no roads, no public transportation. You know, they get in and out of these communities in small 10-seater planes. And each of these communities have several hundred people. In Kivalina, they've been using erosion control methods to try to protect people in place. So in Kivalina, in 2006, I believe, the federal government spent millions of dollars to build a seawall to protect the community in place. Our congressional delegation, one of our U.S. senators, flew in with other federal representatives to celebrate the completion of the seawall. The day of the celebration, a huge storm came in. 180 feet of that seawall was destroyed. And a year later, two-thirds of the community had to be evacuated because of an extreme weather event. They have now rebuilt the seawall, but they are still in danger. The community that I have worked most closely with is called Newtok, and it's also on the coast, and it's further south. And they, unlike Shishmaref and Kivalina, they chose a relocation site that everybody agreed was a good place for them to relocate. So my research has really been following them as they have done everything possible to get themselves to that relocation site. And with every step, so the place where they chose to relocate, no infrastructure there. So they have to build everything in order to be actually able to relocate. And every step that they have taken has been met with, the government is trying, but there are these institutional barriers because there's no population at their relocation site. So, for instance, to build a school in Alaska, you need a minimum of 10 children who are ready to be enrolled in school at your location, but nobody's going to move their family to the relocation site if there's no school. And that is just one of a very small example of the barriers that exist to relocate these communities. So in looking at all of these issues, I tried to figure out, okay, so what can be done? And I've come up with this, what I call an adaptive governance framework based in human rights. And the reason why human rights is critical in this context is because for the government mandated relocations that have happened because of development projects like the building of dams, or for geopolitical reasons like in Alaska during World War II, the Aleuts on the Aleutian Islands were forcibly relocated to theoretically protect them. And it has led to the most disastrous consequences for the people relocated. They've been further impoverished. It's broken their social and kinship networks. And so basing these relocations in human rights is essential. And so we always start with protection in place, right? I mean, that is for any person who is living in a place that they love, relocation is your last thought about how you're going to adapt to climate change. But the reality is sea level is rising, and we don't know how fast, and we don't know when it's going to really inundate places. And so the way that I've conceived it is, and this is all community-based, so communities working with their local governments, and I know that that's the ideal, right, depending on the transparency of the government that is working with the local community, work out these, what I call them, social ecological signals to figure out when protection in place is not possible, so a relocation process could start. And so you look at repetitive loss of structure and extreme weather events and what's happening with saline intrusion in your potable water source, and are your livelihoods being affected, and how is your public health being affected by all these climate change impacts? And then you work towards relocation and getting to safety. In regard to human rights, and one of the aspects of this that makes it unique is that in the context of human rights, we normally think of human rights as being individually based. So I have human rights and you have human rights, but we don't normally think of collective human rights and the collective rights of communities to be together. And that's one of the pieces that really needs to be further worked out and articulated, because for lots of people, and it's not just Indigenous communities, but obviously for Indigenous communities, it may be more intense, is people want to stay together with their family and social networks. And how are we going to make sure that the human rights of everyone is protected when they can no longer stay where they are? Thank you.